Hey there, everybody, and welcome to episode 106 of the epic Vassals of Kingsgrave linear Song of Ice and Fire reread. My name is Bina 007, and I'll be your host today for what may be the last, or indeed maybe penultimate episode. We've already finished all the chapters, so listen to episode 105 for the last chapters. And what we're going to do today is really look at some of the thematic material in A Dance with Dragons to give it its due. We've always ended each book with its own episode or couple of episodes discussing themes and characters and plot. So we thought it would be remiss not to do that for dance. We're going to do a bit of dance trivia as well, and a little bit of podcast trivia too. And then there might be hopefully another episode of this, but potentially not imminent, just with some best of the reread, which Shadow Baby and Lady Weaver are putting together. So that's all the intro blurb. Of course, we'll spoil anything in A Song of Ice and Fire. We'll try not to spoil Game of Thrones. And I am joined today by Mary.
Hello. So yes, it's Mary. I'm Mary on the phones, and very happy to be on our last dance episode.
Yeah, happy to have you here. We're also joined by Vali.
Hey, Matt in real life.
We're also joined by Michael.
Hey, Kawadegi on the forums.
By Noah.
Hey guys, Pops 88.
Jock, you on?
Yeah, I'm Mundo Jock here on the forums.
And hopefully we'll be joined by Blue Armor, aka Matt 2.0, in a while. So before we get into the meat of the Dance with Dragons stuff, I decided to be super nerdy because, hey, we all have time right now, right? And look through all of the episodes that we've published in the reread, including this one, and who had hosted them. And I think it's testament to, I guess, the diversity of hostage that we have on this podcast, that there have been 62 people hosting these episodes, which is kind of more than I'd expected. I thought it might be 30 people. Does that number surprise you guys, or does that feel about right?
Some of the names I don't even recognize as ever talking to or anything.
Jeez, I thought it would be like 12.
Yeah. As someone who's
Yeah.
never hosted, yes.
Well, you've hosted, you're counted in the hosting. It's being on an episode that counts. It's not being the main host.
Right.
I'm assuming, because I don't think there's
Yeah, exactly. It's just anyone who's been on a show. Is how I've done
Like,
it.
who's Joe that was on three episodes?
That's
I
actually
don't.
Pops 88's friend, Joe.
Oh yeah, that's my friend. Yeah,
Oh.
it's my friend Joe.
I was more expecting like 30, like Hubina. 62 seems huge.
There's a lot of one-hit wonders, so people who registered on the
Yeah.
forums did one episode and then decided probably it was way too chaotic and ridiculous for them.
No. That's the fun of it.
I tell you what did surprise me. I started looking at, I thought that a lot more of the episode titles would have penis references to them. I was genuinely surprised that out of 106 episodes, only 9 had titles that reference penises and only 2 reference boobs. I feel that,
I failed.
yeah, I feel that that's really, in fact, there are more episodes with titles that reference Vali than reference boobs. So.
Then I've definitely failed.
He's more popular than boobs. We
Yeah.
have it, ladies and gentlemen.
Vali Mavali.
Yeah, I feel on behalf of the female sort of gender that that should not stand. So I might have to just like put a boob reference into this title just to beat the Vali references.
Find all
I
Vali,
stand by
replace with
that.
boob. Yeah.
I was actually thinking a cool project would be, and then I was like daunted by the actual size of it, was to try to isolate the clips of where each show got its title.
Yeah, I
Because
mean, I
it's
think that would
typically,
be cool. Yeah, that would be
well,
cool.
it's too much work for me, and I just like, I'll throw it out there for anyone else who feels ambitious, but sorry.
Well, you'd have to like listen to all the episodes, and they average sort of 2.5 hours in length, and there's 106 of them. So,
Who's got the
I think
time?
this lockdown would have to continue for some considerable time for us to be asked to do that. But I know that Sarah, Lady Weaver, and Shadow Baby are trying to do something like that, where they listen and find the good bumpers and the good funny bits. So I'm hoping that episode will come out in about a year's time when we've all sort of forgotten about the reread, and then it gives us
And Wind
this,
still hasn't come out,
and Wind still
and
hasn't come out, and it gives us this lovely nostalgia hit.
Well,
So,
we did get an update. We did get an update.
what is the update?
He's still writing.
Yeah,
Still writing.
he's making progress.
Yeah, but at
So
what
no
rate?
update.
At what
Same
rate?
update we got in 2012.
I think you overshot there, Pops, on the information giving. So in terms of the number of people who've been on the most episodes, I have to say, in all arrogance, I really thought I was going to top this list, but I did not.
King Varley.
The Wardens of the Reread. So in all of this, listeners, if you haven't been on the forums of A Podcast of Ice and Fire, if you ever go on there and click on the members, they rank them by, or you can rank them by the number of posts, and they have different titles. So this is like an OG cut for people who were on the forums back in the early days. But the Wardens of the Reread are people who've appeared on more than 30 episodes. So in first position, it is Varley at 62 episodes. So you've been basically on nearly half of the episodes, Matt.
You know how much I've had to neglect my wife and child to make that number happen? It's been a lot of work on my end.
I feel like this is your second child, really. And then I come in at 61, so you literally beat me. Drowned Snow at 46, Nymeria at 41, Nadia at 37, which makes sense because they're all like actual hosts and editors, right?
Yeah.
So does it feel like that, Mary? Does it feel like you've been on like a third of all the episodes? Or more?
Well, it feels like I've been on a lot, but I didn't expect to be that high. I don't know. It's just I've started, I don't know the number when I came first, but
it was number 29.
29. I thought it would be
wow.
High.
Yeah, okay, I was surprised how early it was. And you and Drowned Snow are people who've been on kind of consistently pretty much all the way through, and Varley especially, right? Because he's on the first ones. And whereas Nadia did a lot early but then dropped off, and Carl Bodegi and Blue Armor did a lot late, but Pops did more than I remembered as well. So if you get to House Blackwoody, so people who've done 20 to 30 episodes, you've got Carl Wodegi at 6, Munro Jock at 7, Shadow Baby at 8, Sir Patrick the Tall, who did a lot kind of middle of the reread and then dropped off, Pops at number 10, and Silence at number 11. So yeah, like, and actually it's interesting that Silence, Pops, Sir Patrick and you, Mary, there's a whole bunch in the middle where you did a lot together, which was really nice. I remember those as having a really nice flow to them.
Yeah.
Did you think you'd done as many as that, Pops? I was kind of like semi-surprised at that.
I did. I've been looking 21. Back a bit. No. A lot in the early days.
Yeah.
I think Storms is where you did your thing. Whereas Michael, you did more recently, which is great, because I think without you, I don't think anyone would have volunteered for any of some of that Feast Up stuff.
Yeah, someone had to do it. One away from Wardens, though, that annoys me.
Well, if there's another episode that Sarah Lady Weaver puts out, you should be on that, and then you can break into the 30.
This one doesn't count, right?
No, this counts. This
oh,
is
but that's added into the tally.
Yeah. And then you get to House Ironwoody, the people from 10 to 20. So you've got Blue Armor just in there at number 18. White Raven at 18, which surprised me. I hadn't realised Brett had been on so many. Casey, Blue-Eyed Queen, Lady Weaver, Alias. I hadn't realised Alias had done 13. Amber Rox, Shaggy Dog. Remember, like, early on, Shaggy Dog was so active with his R plus L equals D thing.
Shaggy.
Yeah.
He was hugely dominant. I, Wendell, and Dr. Blood. So.
Sorry, I thought Sarah, both Sarahs, actually, would have done a bit more, but okay.
I think Sarah Lady Weaver did a lot more towards the end of Storm, and then uni kind of kicked in. And I think Dr. Blood, again, it's sort of she comes in and out with pregnancy, so
yeah.
Real life intervenes.
Same with like Queen James, I would have hoped for more. I don't know. Yeah, okay.
So then we get to House Manwoody, the house of this podcast, so to say. And these are people who've done between 5 and 10. So there's quite a few people in here. So people like Queen James, Sedina Roll, the Lord Baron, Claudius the Fool, Inkaz Rain, Valkyrist, Jeddo Whiteheart, the podcast bard, SJ Lee, Zara Lexi, who I haven't heard from in ages, Darcy Mormont, David HHH, Gaydon, Stephen on the forums, who I haven't heard from in a while, and the Wandering Prophet, Wilson. So yeah, some names who definitely have been less active of late, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah, it was interesting to look on the feast recap we did. It was pretty much the same crowd as this, except the Wandering Prophet Wilson was here.
Yeah, there's definitely people who've sort of come in and out of it, I would say. And then House Smallwoody, so people of 3 or 4 episodes, is Chaotic Neutral, 1882, Dagos Rivers, F.T. Ward, Middle Cyclone, Peter Slaylish, 15, Wargasm, Joe, your mate, and Witless Chum. And then on to House Tiny Woody, which is two episodes, Brum Rimbalanda, Dark Sister 24, Enigmas, It Rhymes with Sleep, Jeff 14, K Centurion, Lady Griffin, and Mordian. Mordian doing the first.
I love how Mordian did front and back, and that was it.
That's because I coerced him, basically. And then quite a big group in House Micro Woody, which is like the one and done people. So Archibald, Brock the Black, our first and last, hopefully ever troll. Fire and Bud, Iron Ruhail, Joie Olivier, Joe 13, Serving Stark Realness. Brilliant name. I can't remember that person at all. Skywalzer, Tane Dana, Tedard, Vakasha, and Zane 7. So that'd be the list.
I thought there would honestly be more one-off guys or girls, but yeah, this is surprising.
Well, there's 11. That's quite a lot, though.
Proportionally or whatever to the 65, again, my memory is crap, so this is amazing.
Well, in a way, it's kind of nice because it means people did try and come back for more. They weren't totally put off by the craziness. And I think if you look at a lot of those people who were one and done, they were doing it in the period of peak popularity when there were like 10 to 12 people trying to get into an episode, and it was probably quite frustrating because you felt you weren't getting as much airtime and it was harder to express your views. So I wonder if that had something to do with it too.
Or you just listen to yourself on a podcast and cringe and be like, nope, I'm not putting that out there for the world.
Yeah, exactly. Then I did the podcast pairs for everyone on this podcast, which isn't surprising because we've all podcasted with each other a lot. So Vali and I have been on like 2/3 of casts together.
There we are.
There you go. But I was kind of pleasantly surprised to see I'd done 34% of these with Nadia, because it feels like she hasn't been on since Feast Dance, but it kind of like was nostalgic to think, oh yeah, in the early days we did a lot together. And then I did a lot with Pops and White Raven, which was a pleasant surprise. Like, I would not have predicted that, Noah, I would have done a quarter of these with you. So, Farley, any comments on your pairs?
Let's see. I'm surprised to see I did so many with Nadia. That must have been years ago that I don't remember. But yeah, it's me, you, Adam, Marie Bonjour, Hannah, and White Raven for my top eight. And yeah. Michael and Jock to round it out. I'm surprised I did so many with Tanya, too.
Yeah, there was a middle period and sort of end storm, early feast, I feel, when she did a lot. Nymeria, any thoughts on yours?
I think that if we would go like further down the list and like try to see those a little differently, we would see that I did a lot with probably Sarah, Noah, Tanya, I think, but they just did less overall, I guess. So yeah, but no, I'm not surprised. Like, well, Vali comes first, but he comes first in everything in this podcast. I'm glad to see Jock in there. Well, it's really nice actually to see all those names in my list and everyone else's. The people with
so I cut it off at 25%. Yeah, so Marie, I cut it off at 25%. But on 24% of your personal podcast that you've been on, 24% of the time you've done them with Blue Armor, Nadia, you've done 22% with Pops, and 20% with Silence, 20% with Sir Patrick the Tall, 17% with Iwindiel and Dr. Blood. And like I said, I felt there was a time when Sir Patrick the Tall, Silence, Noah, you, Nadia were kind of like a really, did a run, and maybe with Sarah as well at the end. That was really nice. But yeah, if you look in the spreadsheet, you can do. I've done a sheet for all of you with all of your.
Yes, awesome.
Yes, Michael, any thoughts on your pair ups? Any surprises in there, or people you thought you might have done more with?
Nothing particularly surprising. Just that basically everyone on my list is here today, which I think is interesting.
Taking us into the final.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. Jock, how about you? Any thoughts on your groupings?
Not really. Like, it's same as Michael, like lots of the people here today. I think it has to do with timing. So
yeah.
So it's people available at the same sort of times I'd be available at.
Yeah, I mean, and with me hosting a lot of them, then obviously a lot of them were in European or East Coast friendly time zones, I guess, which wasn't as helpful for the Aussies or the West Coast Americans. Noah, any comments? Surprised that you didn't have Joe in there, your mate? But you've got Silence in there and Nadia, which is quite nice. You've got a nice grouping, I feel.
Yeah, yeah, really nice. Actually, loads with Michael. Marie. And obviously loads with you, because how many times were you just like, we're podcasting in an hour, do you want to jump on?
Usually when Arsenal were doing badly, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I have to say, Noah, one of the things that's getting me through this lockdown is watching Match of the Day with Ian Wright. Did you watch last night? He was so funny.
No, I haven't yet, no.
No, honestly, it's well worth doing. And then Matt, Blue Armour, any surprises in your list of people you thought would be higher or not in there?
No, I mean, the top seven people are the seven people on this call. So.
I feel your list is basically the list that's gotten us through dance. I feel that if you look at, and maybe I should do the stats on this, if you look at the people who were podcasting up until Storm of Swords, there was a lot more mixing it up and a lot more of the one and done or the two and done people were in there. And because the shows were still on, maybe the more popular books, you had lots of different people who were really interested. And as it got further into Feast Dance, that pool of available podcasters really shrunk, because there weren't that many people who were A, still like really into the books and wanting to do this, and they're the less popular books. So it felt like it got a lot less diverse as we went towards the end. But I'm really thankful to all of you on this call, because without you, I don't think this linear reread would have finished. I think it would have just failed.
We are not the hosts you deserve. We are the hosts you need.
Oh, you're definitely the hosts I deserve. At which point, Noah, I think I'll hand over to you for Dance with Dragons trivia.
Yeah. This is kind of in, obviously, I mean, I don't think anyone on this call hasn't done like some sort of quiz at some point.
I don't think I have.
I won $50 really? Bucks at a work quiz this week, so bring it on.
I'm stressed out just thinking of what's going to happen now. So,
well, there is not $50 up for grabs, unfortunately.
Is it the first to type the answer into the chat, or what's going on?
So I guess. How do we want to do this, like between ourselves?
Because I guess we use our names as buzzers.
I think so. I'm gonna be shit. I just want to say that in advance, because I do have a shocking lack of knowledge, but I mean, feel that is appropriate.
The way I've done quizzes with family during this whole thing is just like we'll write it all down and then we'll go through the answers and just add up points. Is it maybe a little less chaotic, unless you really want to compete?
I think we should do chaos, because we are Vok.
Yes. Okay. All right. Okay. Fuck so it. Let's do chaos.
Similar to the Tolkien trivia, you know, where we're just like, bing.
So we write our name in the chat, and that's to buzz.
I thought we yell it out.
No, I thought you write.
I think we just yell it out, because otherwise that punishes
that's
people with longer
most
names.
Chaos-y.
Oh my god.
Oh my god. This is going to be chaos. Wonderful. All right. Well, fuck it.
Let's be proud.
All right. I'm putting my microphone very close.
I know. I'm turning my volume down.
We're gonna die.
Okay. All right. Dance with Dragons quiz. Question one. Upon leaving the wall, Maester Aemon instructs John to read a passage he's marked from the Jade Compendium. What was the passage about?
The flaming sword. And there was heat coming out of the sword. By the way.
I will take Varley's answer as Zor Ahai. I will take he was in there first.
Yeah.
God, you know what? I'm going to be useful here and put down the points, because I think that's my main contribution.
Okay, all right. You can keep score. Question two. John discovers that Melisandre has been glamouring Mance Rayder to appear as Rattleshirt using a ruby worn about his what?
Ring.
Wrist.
Who said wrist?
I did, motherfuckers. Harley comes in first.
Are you sure it's not a ring?
It's definitely his wrist. It's
oh
a ruby.
Oh god, I'm so embarrassed.
Yeah, I thought it was like a bracelet or something.
Yeah, it was a bracelet. I did have multiple choice there with some funny alternatives, but you know, anyway. Question three, and I promise they're not all about John. John beheads the deplorable Janos Slynt for disobeying his order to take command of which re-garrisoned castle?
Greywatch?
Ooh, no.
No, it's he said re-garrisoned the Queen's Castle. or whatever it's called.
You're very trusting, though, because we're all on the internet, right, on our laptops.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course. And it's very easy to find this one.
Greyguard? It's something great.
There you go.
Yes!
Ding, ding, ding.
I couldn't even type Janice Slinton in time.
He's off the mark. All right, question four. Moving on away from the war to warmer climates. In which SOC town does Jorah Mormont kidnap Tyrion?
Valantis.
No.
Oh,
Sel'Horis.
Yes.
That's nice. That's deep cut.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Because the show did Volantis, so I wanted to...
Yeah, I've committed the mortal sin of mixing canons.
I know. Okay, question five, moving very far away from the show. Daenerys discovers that King Cleon of Astapor has fallen. What are the names of the king and queen that succeed
King Cutthroat
him?
King and Queen Whore.
Ooh, well done.
Wow. Michael is just saying shit off.
I was like, Cleo the Butcher.
Okay. During the adventures of Quentin, he encounters a member of the Windblown with a Valyrian steel what?
Arras.
And what was the guy's name?
Cargo Corpskiller.
Jesus.
Wow. Nice.
Oh, man. Michael might come in first here.
I'm surprised you, Michael, is coming up first.
He uses the Valyrian steel Arrak on the King of Astapor, and it cleaves right through that copper armor.
Was that the king that was already a dead corpse?
Yeah, the corpse one.
Yeah. They strapped him to his horse.
Hence, corpse killer, or whatever.
Question seven. Still got four more left, Varley. Loads of time to play.
Okay.
Following the events at Dathnak's Pit, Drogon flies Dany across the Dothraki Sea and settles on a hill, which she dubs what?
Dragonstone. Could Varley got it first?
I took it before you're even done.
Yeah, it's Varley. It's you, Varley. Okay.
All right. That's a big one. Question eight. What does Jaime find between the teats?
Any tree in the town.
Happiness.
Yes, it is Penny Tree. Well done. I feel like this is a two-horse race, but I hope everyone else is enjoying this. question nine. On her first assassination assignment, how does Arya assassinate the old
poison
man?
The coin. In the water, that's poison.
Yeah, and he bites it.
Yes.
So what did Matt say?
It was a poisoned coin. That's how he assassinated the old man.
Yeah, that's what I said, by the way. I got it right.
Who said it first? But Matt said something as
no,
well.
No, he said Arya.
Something that was wrong.
Oh,
okay. I got it right, by the way.
Okay.
All right, final question. And let's hope this is a trick one. Prior to her Walk of Atonement, how many of the Kettleblack brothers does Cersei admit
two.
To sleeping with?
Osni and... That. Oh, fuck, you said admit three. She says three to the High Sparrow.
It is three. It is all of them.
Damn it, Michael. Well, I bow to you, friend.
Thanks for giving us more than one guess.
Michael has 7 points. And Polly, three.
Ugh.
A brutal shootout.
And zero for the rest of us.
Well, good. That was very fun to put together. Thanks, guys.
It was fun, to listen to.
Maybe you can do this at home and see if you can beat Michael.
Oh, my ego would have been so damaged if I didn't win that. Oh, that was so stressful.
Man, you had all the Essos questions in the bag.
I've reread Dennis chapters, guys. You know?
True.
Some people
true,
do it.
It's true. It's, yeah.
Oh, well, this is a nice segue then, because it's Michael, with his deep cut knowledge, he's going to take us through the thematic discussion.
Wearing the crown of knowledge.
Exactly. Cool. Over to you, Michael.
All right. So now we're going to the themes of A Dance with Dragons. So I'm going to read Bina's summary for the first one. The first is Ruling the Peace. And the main two characters here are John and Danny. Their approaches radically differ. Their outcomes don't. They all lose their power, at least temporarily. John and Daenerys are at opposite ends of the compromise spectrum. John is uncompromising and forces his vision of the peace through against all resistance. In the end, his brothers are left behind by his policy, not convinced or adequately informed about it, and turn against him. Daenerys, on the other hand, compromises to the point of self-denial. She accepts the point of view and sensibilities of the Myrrhenese, leaving her own power base in the dust and betraying her ideals. In the end, it is hard to decide if Meereen is her city at all, or if she just restored it completely. Supporting characters for these story arcs, there is Barristan Selmy, who advises Daenerys with surprising capability and takes up the rulership after her disappearance. And there is Melisandre trying to guide and warn Jon, suffering from the fact that she needs guidance as well, since her reading of the fires is most certainly wrong regarding Azor Ahai. So what do you think of these two characters?
I'd like to add the Brothers of the Night's Watch, as well as Selyse, into who's trying to influence Jon.
Mm. And Sans, I think, at the start as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's obviously quite a lot of characters.
And they're all going in different directions.
Yeah. I mean, I really like this theme, and I think this is one of the reasons why the reread of Dance turned out to be far more interesting to me and fulfilling to me than it might have been. And I really like this idea of this Dany, like, I didn't really enjoy a lot of her chapters, but this concept of a colonial ruler trying to enforce peace in a book written at the time of the Gulf Wars, kind of provocative and interesting. And then similarly with John. And with John, I just think he's in such an invidious position. It's like, so what would you do? And it really got to me when we did those final few episodes of just seeing him lose the confidence of his people and get more and more king-like and more deaf to people trying to argue against him. And it's just like, you see him make these mistakes, like getting rid of all his supporters, not realizing he's doing that. And it's so tragic. So I think his mistakes are more like a tragic hero's mistakes, like very Shakespearean. And Dany, I feel, is more contemporary. It feels like they're two stories, like they're two things in the same theme. But it feels to me like his is very much in the tradition of great literature. And hers is much more just a comment on contemporary society. And I kind of like the contrast.
I would also add with Dany, there's a lot of parallels to the Reconstructionist South after the Civil War of America.
Oh.
So you have, I think this is what George has based it on, like the Sons of the Harpy are the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I did not know this.
And Dany's like Abraham Lincoln.
Wow. But there's no, like, carpetbaggers. There's no one coming from the north to profit largely off the back, or at least we're not seeing that, and, you know, with them under siege. I think okay, that...
Not 100%, but very parallel.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be an exact correspondence to be an influence or, yeah.
So not that I know a whole heap about American history, but you have Abraham Lincoln.
Americans don't know either, so don't worry.
And he had talked with the freed slaves, and he was planning to give them plots of land to aid in their, you know, franchisement. But then he gets killed, and his successor, whose name I'm blanking on, maybe you Americans know it. Yeah, John Wilkins Booth. He basically backtracked on all of Abraham Lincoln's policies, and you were left in this difficult era.
Yeah, Booth was the assassin. It's Buchanan who was his follower.
That's it.
He's considered the worst president ever.
Yeah, so this sort of mirrors Danny's two states of mind. I think one of the really key things is in A Storm of Swords, when Barristan comes with that crucial information that, you know, your father was the Mad King, has no one told you? And so Dany spends a lot of A Dance of Dragons worrying that she is going to go mad and be crazy. And she's worried about, you know, releasing the dragons, unleashing the dragon in that sense. And that's one of the things that causes her to basically just pussy out and not try and go harder on the slavers. But yeah, what do you guys think?
Yeah, and I agree. I think that her last chapter in Dance shows that kind of pivot point where, you know, I think she hears Quaithe say, or Jorah say, that, like, the dragons know who you are, do you? Like, I think that's where she's going to turn and come down a little harder on everyone.
I think I was more invested into in John's stories, story throughout Dance. And it was the same in my first read and in this reread that I was just really like, yeah, really into it. And I'm always more, I always feel like he didn't make that many mistakes and that it didn't turn out well, but I don't think he could have really made it better. It was really tragic, like you said, Bina. I really agree with the idea that these two situations are written about very differently in John's case and Danny's case.
Yeah, I would say John's story arc is a lot easier to just get and understand. It took me several rereads to really dissect Danny's arc and what was going on there.
I mean, it just, all these different factions, and they all have names that you can't pronounce, and just like trying to just, you know, at least John's political machinations are all with characters that we know and have known for five books, and factions or types of people or houses that we're familiar with. So it's the kind of the final development of things that have been put in place for a long time, whereas with Danny we're just running to catch up, as is she. And in a way, that's what makes me a bit sympathetic with her, because she's in the same position we are, which is just trying to figure out what the hell's going on, trying to do the best, but always ending up in a very compromised situation. So
isn't that the problem? Yeah, maybe so was George.
He
got lost just like the rest of us.
Well, it's interesting, you know, like you could obviously see parallels between the timing of the release of the book and the Iraq war and, you know, what was going on with the U.S. and Afghanistan and stuff like that. It'll be interesting to see, like, how maybe, you know, current events are kind of outlining his writing now. Like, maybe we'll get more of a grayscale thing than he anticipated getting. Maybe, you know, there'll be some kind of, you know, buffoon king somewhere. It'll be interesting to see what parallels we can draw, because I think, especially in Marine, even the surroundings is very, you know, invocative of Afghanistan, the Middle East, desert, you know.
So I say tranny.
Nope, but I thought of that as well.
and that's the benefit. If you do feast dances too and see them together, then you have three people trying to rule Cersei, John, and Danny, right? And all failing. So
and all
you realize,
different types of failing.
Yeah, you just realize how good these books are and how good the kind of thematic structure is to have these three things going on together.
So does that give like Robert a little more cred because he was able to hold all this shit together for so long? And like in the matter of what, a year and a half, we have like nine different kings and no one can do anything right?
Yeah, but Robert didn't have civil war.
And then peace.
Yeah.
I give the credit to John Arryn. Robert just got by with a very good Secretary of State, if we're making current parallels.
It wasn't a hard job, though.
And then he followed whatever his advice was, which is already kind of a good thing.
Sometimes no government's better than bad government, right? I mean, I remember like at one point recently, I think it was like 2012 or something, we were doing our macro forecast for Europe, and Belgium was in one of its often held positions where it hadn't had a government for like 15 months and wasn't about to get one. And it had by far the best like growth prospects of anywhere in Europe, because everyone else that had a government was inflicting austerity policies on the economy. And sometimes you're just like, yeah, just like a drunken fool of a king who just lets the technocrats get on with ruling in peacetime. And who has a Chancellor of the Exchequer who's just debt financing, you know, bread and circuses for the people through tournaments. That actually makes for decent kingship against a very low benchmark.
With Robert, I always get a bit of a parallel to Viserys I Targaryen, who precedes the Dance with Dragons. And like his reign was good, but the neglect and all of the, you know, excesses, and he just wouldn't deal with what needed to be dealt with, manifests immediately after his death, and the realm is plunged into civil war. So the good parts and bad parts, and in Robert's case, I'd say Littlefinger's embezzlement, which just went completely unchecked, and the Lannisters' over-influence, these were problems that were going to strike. They were just waiting for Robert to die.
So like he just rode a nice little wave of like market trend and political trend that was like, everything was doing all right, and now everything's crashing down.
Yeah, going on the coattails of his forebears.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to be worse than a mad king, so I guess good for Robert.
I didn't expect we'd get such a great quote from Roose about peace. His quote about a peaceful land, a quiet people, that has always been my rule,
right.
When he's talking to Ramsay.
Yeah, no one talks about the horrific acts that take place. If I can make a diversion to Australian politics, our wonderful Prime Minister was campaigning about he serves quiet Australians. And every time I hear him say, oh, I serve quiet Australia, it just makes me think of Bruce Bolton.
The silent moral majority.
Yeah,
of that,
exactly.
The real America.
Exactly.
And we're watching the plot against America right now, which is phenomenal. And
oh my God, it's so scary.
And there are lots of references to, you know, these Jewish people on the coast being sent to discover the real America, you know, being repatriated to Kentucky or some shit. And no offense to people in Kentucky, but everywhere in America is the real America. Every part of that diverse and beautiful country is real. it's such dog whistle phraseology. It really is.
Yeah. It's not scary to live here at all.
Do we want to comment on the advisors and what a bum task it is? I mean, if you're Barristan Selmy, if you're Melisandre, I mean, these are thankless tasks.
Barristan, really steps up. Like, it was a real precarious position that he manages to hold together. And, you know, as he says himself, he has no experience in ruling or taking this kind of role. So, yeah, good on Barristan.
Yeah, I agree. He did very well in his capacity to do anything, right? they're in a strange land with strange people, and he manages to do better than most.
Although he did sit on, like, the small council for, like, 14 years,
Yeah, which I would consider sort of a failing. I kind of think that Barristan was just like tuning out for all of these things. He was just like, I'm guarding the king. I'm not going to pay attention to anything.
I would expect like it still had some kind of impact. He has some kind of experience, even if he didn't take part or even didn't listen quite closely to what was happening on the small councils. He was still there and seeing how it was done, even passively.
Yeah, like he thinks, how would each of the kings that he have served react to the way Hizda reacts when he gets a head thrown at his feet? And that was really interesting.
Yeah. Counterfactual history, if Sam hadn't been sent away, would John have been knived?
I think Sam would have been knived first.
I think they would both have been.
I feel
he would have tempered him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. I don't think John gets knifed. Sam.
I mean, don't forget that Sam's a crafty little bastard. He's the one who got John elected in the first place.
It's really funny. If any of you listen to the latest podcast of Ice and Fire episode that came out today, it is on that Sam, on that episode where where Sam wheedles the election. And it's, you just kind of forget how awesome Sam is because we left him a long time ago in this reread.
Yeah.
Like, that guy is a crafty little shit. And I say that with all respect. I think he would have.
Well, I won't say too much more on this because it will lead into our Azor Ahai conversations later.
Oh, okay. Oh boy.
Okay. It's rock and roll.
So what would Sam have done? Just advise John not to send away his allies?
No, I think he would have told him when he was letting in the wildlings. I think he would have lobbied on his behalf and tried to bring people on side in a way that John gets very high-handed about. And I think he would never have let John just make that speech and say, right, here's a pink letter, we're marching south. I think Sam would have been aghast and would have advised him against all of that. I think that desperate final throw of the dice comes of feeling very isolated and very entitled, actually. And Sam would have just kept him in check from all of that.
Yeah, at the end, John just has no one left to call him out. Like, he is just absolutely sick and tired of what Bowen Marsh and Septon, whatever, Celador are saying. And he hates their guts. But
they're the head of people of their divisions, and they are the people that should be like, we shouldn't do this. Like, you know, they have that role for a reason.
They've told him, and he hasn't listened. So, you know.
He's thinking, you know, I need to listen to their advice, but he's also getting incredibly frustrated. He's like, I know what they're going to say even before they say it, and they never cease to surprise me. So he's basically, by the end of the dance, he's just discounted their opinions essentially as just being useless.
Yeah, but he'd think even the same thing as Sam. Like, he'd be like, oh, you don't want to do this because you don't have the courage to stand up to Bowen Marsh or whatever. Like, I can see him making excuses to Sam the same way.
Sam has ways of getting around John. Like you've seen this in the past, right back to a Game of Thrones where John is being all butthurt that he's got to be a steward, not a ranger. And Sam is able to just explain to him, no, this is a good idea. Stop being an idiot. So I feel like he has that intelligence and charisma that would cut through in a way that it wouldn't with Bowen Marsh.
I think this is the first time anyone's ever said Sam's has charisma.
He does. Yeah, again, I've also listened to that podcast by a podcast of Ice and Fire, and I think it's great. It does Sam justice.
Indeed. Yeah, absolutely. On to the next scene.
Yes. Oh, anyone have anything else they want to say about ruling? Okay, so the second theme is the journey to yourself. The story arc is most developed in Tyrion and the least developed in Quintin, but that is mainly a product of the page count for these characters and the purposes they serve for the overall story. Quintin, a new character, only has 4 chapters, and these are mainly deconstructions of the classical knight's quest or tale, since he fails consequently. Through his eyes, we see the fall of Astapor, though, and the working mechanisms of the mercenary companies. He also releases the dragons, thereby changing the dynamics of Meereen. He never really becomes self-aware, though, thinking that he has a destiny to fulfill that is clearly not his. Lastly, there is Tyrion. In my initial review, I stated that his chapters are disappointing. This is Bina's words, by the way.
This is from Stefan Sasse, I should say. I should have said that.
Sorry.
This is coming from his Dance with Dragon reread blog, which I thought was really valuable.
Stefan Sasse is good. That's good. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't want to throw you under the bus, Bina.
No, I just thought not that he's going to be listening to this, but if anyone's listening who's read his blog, they'll be like, what? This sounds a bit familiar.
Dragging endlessly as of a kind of Essos road movie. This is at most half true, however. Tyrion is the character that is most profoundly lost. His chapters reflect that. At the beginning of A Dance with Dragons, he is permanently drunk, shoved around by everyone, and pushed and pulled in all directions, willingly submitting to whatever path is laid out before him. On the journey with Connington and Aegon, he finds much of himself again, but is still plagued by his inner demons and without his own impetus. It takes his captivity and enslavement to reactivate the old Tyrion. At the end of A Dance with Dragons, Tyrion is grasping for opportunities, found his wits again, and takes control of even the most desperate situations, most like he did in A Game of Thrones. So what do you guys think on personal chapters?
Yeah, I think Quintin is very sad as a character, not because he dies, because he doesn't, but because he doesn't seem to grow at all in the chapters that we meet him in. He doesn't seem to get self-awareness. He's bought the idea that he is a great prize, that he's a Prince of Dawn, or that Dany should be pleased to be married to him. He doesn't grasp the situation when he gets there, that he's almost to be pitied by her and shoved aside. And he still thinks he can make this grand gesture at the end, that he is someone who can free and ride a dragon and that will impress her. I mean, it's so delusional. And then it always brings me back to Doran and his inability to suitably educate and teach his children and give them any kind of skills, in the sense that Ned and Tywin, as bad parents they can be in some respects, have done for their children. I just find it, he's set up to fail and he does fail. But the tragedy is that we never see him in this journey through Essos take an interest in learning about the people around him more. He never seems to benefit from the cultural, for many people who go on gap years or go traveling in their youth, it's a massive change in their worldview, because they're just seeing different people and environments for the first time. And there's just no growth. And I guess, maybe deliberately, that is George telling us something about the kind of classic hero's tale where they don't really have much inner life or development. But I find him to be deeply, deeply tragic. That is that it? We're introduced, he fails, he dies, and what was his life for? And it just makes me really, really hold his father in contempt. And I'm kind of curious to see how the story with Arianne develops in the next book, and whether George brings a comeuppance to Doran for all his delusional meddling.
I just saw Quentin as someone with a job to do, and he wasn't there to do a gap year or build any orphanages. He was there to get a bride and come back to Westeros.
But what was his job narratively then? Why did George need to have him when he clearly wasn't that interested in his
bride? He didn't need to have him.
That he wanted someone to release a dragon? Is that literally it?
Narratively, his death is going to serve to turn Dorne against Daenerys.
Okay, yes. So it splits the Targaryens.
They will burn with Aegon.
Yeah, and Doran is about to hear a very biased story from Garrus Drinkwater about how Dany laughed at him and mistreated him, blah, 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 blah. And Ariane will be horrified to find out the what story she hears about how Dany treated Quentin and stuff. So
it would probably just be a merchant, much like how a lot of the news traveled early on about dragons and stuff.
Yeah, I can see that as well, hearing garbled tales that are not, that it's like telephone, where only the worst things come true. But yeah, I feel...
It will really, like, serve to depict Dany as the kind of crazy Targaryen that she's trying to avoid.
Yeah, which makes things all the more tragic.
Yeah.
I feel like Garrus's fate is probably tied more to Barristan now, post-Quentin. Mm-hmm.
So when Barristan goes to, yeah, Garrus and Archibald Ironwood, he says, you know, if you help me turn the tattered prince over to our side, I'll send you and Quentin's bones back to Dorne. And I just have a feeling that they might succeed in getting to Dorne. Maybe pirates kill them or whatever, but that just seems the most likely scenario. But we'll see. We'll see.
So you think that it'll turn Daenerys... I mean, are we doing spoiler chapters, Bina?
Is everyone here okay to do spoiler chapters?
Let's go.
Yeah, I think we're good.
Okay. So we know that Arya is going to meet with Fagon, so isn't there an alliance building there anyway?
Well, and again, this is going to be very interesting, because in Aegon and Arianne's eyes, this is a good alliance to make. You know, Arianne is getting Dorne onto Team Targaryen in her mind. But as Daenerys will discover, Aegon he's not a Targaryen. He ain't part of Team Targaryen. And when Daenerys gets there to King's Landing or Westeros, she's going to be like, get the fuck out of here, Aegon. You are an imposter. And yeah, there will be animosity between these two, yeah, people.
Well, I mean, Dorne's tied to Fagon, you know, kind of regardless. If they believe that he is Elia's son, then he's half Dornish, you know? So I think
I agree.
It won't matter if it turns out.
Without the marriage.
Well, in both ways, Dorne is now tied to Aegon, and by association, that makes them enemies of Daenerys.
Yeah, regardless of Quentin, but I think Quentin is still like
plum on the pudding.
Yeah, cherry on top. Yeah.
Mm.
I also think that, like, who dies in dance?
Well, not Quentin.
And not John, right? No one dies.
No, John's dead. John's dead. I will bet any amount of money that he is dead.
He needs a real death from time to time. Mm. Someone who won't come back. And someone who's definitely dead, like Quentin. Sorry, Bina. So I don't know if that's the whole point of Quentin. I think he kind of hoped, and it's a fail, that we would be more invested emotionally in Quentin's journey.
Yeah, I just feel George was starting on the back foot here by introducing a new character, again, in a foreign setting of Essos. And this is just more growing pains of having to stretch out the story, and the tale grew in telling.
Yeah, shall we move on to Tyrion?
Yes.
Because this is the big journey, isn't it? I mean, he starts dance in such a negative place, and by the end is kind of back. I mean, that's what's so exciting about TWOW, is Tyrion back on the top of his game, who has learnt a lot about the world and about his scent and about his himself. And I'm very excited to see what he gets up to.
Yeah, and again, this is something I appreciate, again, for multiple rereads, is looking at Tyrion's arc all throughout, going from the lowest of the lows to a functional position at the end of A Dance with Dragons. That doesn't mean I think a few of his chapters could have been cut, you know? I think there's two on the Roin, where at the end of one chapter he figures out who Aegon is but doesn't say, and then at the end of the second one, when they get attacked by the Stone Men, he then says who Aegon
is.
Yes,
yes, yes.
And I feel like these two could have been put together very easily.
Oh yeah, I mean, they're very baggy in the same way as the Dany chapters are baggy, but it's an arc that I'm much more invested in. And I was kind of proud of George, not proud of George, so I'd say condescending. I was interested that George would let Tyrion get so dark. And I think that was bold. And it's interesting that he's brought him back. One wonders if he'll bring Arya back. I hope not in a way, because I just think all the favourite characters shouldn't be able to just come back from that level of darkness and spite. But, yeah.
I feel like Tillian's dark flew out, just it was not at the surface, like, not directly within his thoughts. Like, he did some pretty horrible stuff well before our dance.
Yeah, but because he's our Tyrion, we kind of forgive him a lot of stuff in the earlier books. I agree, Jack.
I think Tyrion as an advisor going forward to Daenerys is going to be much more villainous, is not the right word, but provocative. You'll remember in Quaithe's prophecy, she says, you know, Tyrion is coming to you, the snarling lion or whatever, and she says, do not trust him, which I think is very telling advice. So I would say that the darkness is not completely gone from Tyrion, and this is going to manifest in the advice that he gives.
Completely agree, yeah. I agree with both Chuck and Michael that he was dark before and he is even darker now, and will kind of stay the same. Like, he's not in his low points where he would be both dark and just useless. He's back to being manipulative and witty and everything, but the darkness and the bitterness is still there, I think.
Oh yeah, I agree. And you can't sort of kill your own father, you know, I mean, like, you're going to be and dark, right? That doesn't just, that doesn't wash away. You know, elastic band ping back from that. So, fair play, really.
And I mean, kill your own father, being put into slavery, all of those things are hard to come back from.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a great journey, and it's a great arc. Just obviously needed some editing and pruning.
And yeah, it's exciting to see him in Winds, just because it does feel a little unfinished, where John and Danny had their clear ending points of various of getting killed and flying on a dragon, whereas while Tyrion, you know, his development is bringing him back more towards his old self. His narrative arc just kind of seems to just kind of like stop at a point when the book ran out of pages, and so it does feel a little unfinished, which, you know, maybe made the wait a little worse. But it's definitely exciting to see how he interacts with Dany going forward.
Making Tyrion go so very dark was controversial, and a lot of people were complaining, you know, I miss old Tyrion. And I almost found that to be condescending, in a sense that you just want Tyrion to be the comical dancing dwarf that makes fun of these situations. And I'm like, it's almost, yeah, it's condescending. You know, he's been through shit. He's going to go dark. So I appreciate what George did.
What's up next?
Let's move to what isn't there. Two things one would have expected to play a role in the book that don't. The Others and the Dragons. The Others never even make an appearance again after having been featured so heavily in A Storm of Swords. And dragons are either chained or fled early in A Dance with Dragons and continue to play a role only in the final stages of the book. Several people have expressed doubts whether the Others would, after this pause in their appearance, pose a conceivable threat in the Winds of Winter, or if they would just be viewed as a convenient plot device. Again, one has to read carefully and be aware. Throughout John's chapters, the threat of the Others is always there. They make no appearance, but the Wildlings, who refused to talk about it, were seriously attacked by them in the aftermath of the battle with Stannis. And everything John does, really everything, is driven by the knowledge that the Others are out there and that they are in a fight of life versus death. His failure to realize is all of this and do nothing to convince others, mainly Bowen Marsh.
Yeah, that's actually one of the most, to me, that's probably the most frustrating part of John's chapters, whereas like everyone at the Wall seems to treat the Others like Voldemort. And that they just refuse to talk about them and really like emphasize like what a threat they are, and it's really infuriating to me.
Yeah, agreed.
But I agree that that George does a good job of mentioning their threat and just kind of like how big their armies are becoming and like kind of the efforts they're making to create more whites and whatnot.
You see, I thought the whole point of the Hardhome debacle was that the Others were there, that, you know, that's why the people needed rescuing.
Oh, they're there, but we just don't see them physically. It's
right,
just
but do we need to? I mean,
dead things in the water.
Mm.
I think, I mean, the other thing I think does loom, because it looms over the wildlings and therefore over John's entire narrative. The one that pisses me off is the lack of dragonage, because this book is called Dance with Dragons. There is no dancing of dragons in this book. But if anything, that's going to be T-Wow, because then it's going to be Dany versus Fagon. And okay, there's a bit of dragon action at the end of Dany, but like, this is a big book. There ain't no dancing with dragons. It's a stupid title for this book.
Yeah, but Barristan said it about Quentin, so boom, there it is. Title drop.
You have to be a bit more metaphorical in your interpretation that, oh, Dany is a dragon and John is a dragon and Aegon is a...
I feel that George should take more attention on titling his books than we take on titling our episodes. We do throwaway lines in our episode and that becomes an episode title.
I think they're just supposed to be, like, especially the others are always supposed to be this almost existential threat. And what I don't understand is when the wildlings are getting attacked by them, the Night's Watch has been attacked by them, and they're survivors of the Fists of the First Men at the wall, and somehow they still don't get it.
I think it's quite realistic when you see what's happening right now in the real world. I mean, that when something is that new and that scary and that impactful on everything you know as being real and life, it's quite human to just be like, well, but that night was so chaotic. Maybe it's a one-time thing. Maybe I didn't see what I thought I saw. I think it's not that weird, and I guess there aren't that many survivors, and it's all a bit tainted by John coming back with the wildlings, and like all of this takes first place in everyone's minds, and no one really listens to anyone else.
If you think about it, who survived the Fist of the First Men also had to survive the mutiny at Craster's Keep.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then it's like 40 people. So they're in the minority.
Yeah. And then of those people, John sent out a bunch of rangers out amongst them, Kedge Whiteye and Garth Greyfeather, who were at Craster's Keep. So it's like, you're running out of people. Sam was there as well. Ed Tollett. So like, I mean, what? 30 people enough to persuade 200?
They are actually the same people that we regret John sends away from him. So, yeah.
And in A Storm of Swords, and also in A Dance with Dragons, they make a point of emphasizing Bowen Marsh commanded a battle against the wildlings at the Shadow Tower, and there were, like, grievous losses. The Bridge of Skulls, and there were huge losses on the Night's Watch part.
Yeah.
And this has clearly impacted Bowen Marsh in his, you know, perception of who's the bigger problem.
Which is fair.
He took a grave injury. Like, he used to be, what, Lord Pomegranate or whatever? Now he's just a regular, you know, douchebag, I guess.
But I mean, it's like John. We have to remember that he's been in the Night's Watch for like 2 years, maybe not even. I don't know. So when you think about the people who have been there for decades, it's ingrained in them that the wildlings are the enemy, and it's not easy for them to completely change gear and be like, oh no, wait, that's the others. So I think it's quite realistic that that people would doubt that it's such a big threat.
Yeah, but I think you see that in any like ingrained organization, and maybe Bina can speak to this more directly as far as business goes, that there's always a tension when someone is promoted from without rather than promoted from within. So, yeah, like you said, John's been in the Night's Watch for a little over a year, and now he's leading them, and not, you know, Dennis Malister, who's been there for ages, or...
And also with extreme youth as well, you know, not someone who came in, was sent to the wall, but had experience in the outside world of leading and governing. Basically, a person who's there, you know, it's not a meritocracy, it's just some nobleman's bastard. Is suddenly leapfrogging over people with many years of experience. I mean, if you look at it objectively, it is absurd that he's leading the Night's Watch, frankly. And his inexperience is what leads him to fuck up at the end.
So you think that, like, it would have been okay if Ned was sent to the Wall like he was supposed to, and then he became...
Yeah, exactly.
Because he was a High Lord, and he led armies in the past.
And managing people and bringing people on side, which, you know, John, it's not his fault. He has not got the skills or experience to do the job at hand, to lead a team during a time of crisis.
Well, either did Rob. So I guess Ned really fucked up his leadership training.
Well, it's not.
I would argue that Rob did. Rob, like, he has a different lord ride with him every day, and he understands his northern men. I would say that he doesn't understand Edmure, but that's another thing entirely.
But he can't have. I mean, they all turn against him, right? Well, I mean,
okay, the Freys turn against him, and the Boltons turn against him. But like, the Boltons
and the Karstarks
thing going on. I think it would be a bit unfair to put that all on Rob.
Yeah, Rob got a very unlucky. A lot of dominoes had to collapse, for the Red Wedding to happen. So yeah, lots of factors in play.
But like, back to the initial point, I think that the others are actually there in the book. They're really looming over everything, and you feel the, like, their presence, and how John at least is aware and scared. But I agree with Bina that the dragons, they are also here in the politics of Meereen, but not enough. Just and it's really frustrating to see Dany ignoring them throughout the whole book.
Just when read the Desnax Pit chapter, or any time there's dragon action, there's a lot of it's just enjoyable listening to the dragons burn people alive and rip people apart. It's just nice.
Jesus Christ!
I just love it.
Take back my that I started saying at the beginning of your sentence.
it's prime popcorn munching material. Like.
Matt, you wanted to say.
It's also emblematic of the frustrating part of Danny's chapters, where, you know, and especially for me, where it was very obvious from, like, the first, you know, few chapters, like, the end point she needed to get to with embracing the fire and blood personality. And it takes, you know, what, 15 chapters and a bunch of pages to get there. And so, like, that, and that's just symbolized by the fact that she keeps her dragons locked up in a pit. So yeah, I can understand the frustrations with that.
God, imagine how many people Drogon's going to burn in the Winds of Winter. Like, there's many Dothraki that are just going to go up in flames. Yeah. It's going to be
good
great.
God, your manhood is showing.
So
Westerosi barbecue.
I do think that the frustration is both intentional and really telling of Danny's state of mind. And I think you're right, Matt. It's really, she needs to go to the point where she goes back to fire and blood, and that goes with the dragons. But like a lot of things in this book, maybe it lasted just a bit too long. And even though we know it's necessary for the story to develop and for it to be satisfying at the end of it, the length of it is a bit frustrating.
So unless anyone has anything else to say, the final theme to look at is prophecies. You could argue we see the fulfillment of the Azor Ahai prophecy in John's last chapter. Sir Patrick of the Mountain sports a big star as a sigil and gets beaten to a bloody pulp. Therefore, we have the bleeding star, John's wounds smoke, and Marsha's crying. So we have the salts in his tears. Now John only needs to survive somehow or be reborn, and we have the prophecy fulfilled in the unlikeliest form ever imaginable. Such small details, which may be, keep in mind, totally meaningless distractions, can be found all throughout the book. What do we think on prophecies that come true or are laid down in this book?
Well, if you think John's really dead, then the Azor Ahai prophecy hasn't been fulfilled.
Well, he has to be reborn into the world, or whatever they call it.
Does there have to be one Azor Ahai?
Yeah, this is my
thing. Multiple people fulfill different parts of the prophecy?
With the prophecies, I think it's saying, who is Azor Ahai? Who's the prince that was promised? This can apply to so many candidates that it's, I don't waste a lot of brain space thinking about this because, yeah, there are multiple, Three Head has the dragon, so there are multiple people that it would seem can fill this criteria. And yeah, once you get far enough, Victarion can count as a candidate for Azor Ahai.
I couldn't agree more because there are so many things possible. Like I was going to say earlier, the Crassus Keep mutiny is also a lot of evidence for Sam being reborn there, considering he then following that kills another and kind of starts his hero's journey, if you will. There are so many cases for so many people, and it's kind of also the history aids it as well, because when you look back, there are several different
retellings, stories.
Yeah, exactly. Not just different names, but almost like different parts of the world. They claim to have the savior there, the last hero. What's the other one?
Harkun the hero.
That's it. Yeah. So I fully agree with you. I think it's going to be almost a puzzle, Azor Ahai, as opposed to just one in person, cut and dry.
So I have a question with the John thing, because as we all know, Sir Patrick of Star Mountain is a reference to football, American football. The Patriots have a blue star as their thing.
Yeah, it was his friend.
The Dallas Cowboys, guys.
Yeah, okay, Dallas Cowboys, yeah. And he gets killed by a giant whose name 1-1 is number 11, so haha, isn't that clever? But my question is, when did this event happen in the real world? Was it like 2010, or was it like ages ago?
The bet occurred?
Yeah, when the bet occurred that George then decided to incorporate in.
It was mid-2000s, because it was the Super Bowl, but it wasn't the Super Bowl.
It had to be the playoffs, because they're in the same division.
Yeah, exactly.
He also has Bill Belichick in, who's a coach of the Patriots, and his name is like Bill Belichickus or something, got crushed by a giant, and he mentions it in passing as another little footballer.
Yeah, he was part of Volantis in the World of Ice and Fire, I think.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, so do you think that it's bullshit because this is just a little nod of the cap to his buddy for losing a bet instead of like a fulfillment of prophecy?
I just want to know the timing because, I mean, after I said let's not dedicate too much thought space to it, it genuinely could just be a coincidence. But I do agree it does. This one does fit nicely. But yeah, that's interesting.
Well, I mean, the details of the details of, you know, Sir Patrick, you know, came in late. But I imagine John's death had been planned many years before that. So. Still in the works.
If the Cowboys had beaten the Giants, we wouldn't have a bleeding star, is what I mean.
But he might have figured out something else. Like, I'm sure, you know, given how he's, you know, included clues for people like Victarion and Davos, I'm sure he could have thought of something for John as well.
Yeah, that is a good point.
Maybe you'd have just sent some sort of long distant Dane up north or something. Dildo Dane at the wall.
Dildo?
Well, just, I don't know, some alliteration.
The White Phallus of the Morning.
And there we have our episode title.
Ah, it's another dick one. It's no boobs at all.
That's fitting.
So also concerning prophecy, we have Daenerys's, when she's doing her walk, she sees the Dothraki Sea is like, well, it's not dying, but it's going dry during autumn. The pyramids are burning, and some people think this is when the sun rises in the west and sets in the east. Quentin's death, Arianne, whatever. I don't think this is true. I'm just bringing it up. What do you guys think?
Bullshit.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no, I like the narrative choice of Danny not being able to have heirs, and so I really hope he doesn't go away from that.
So but even the end point of the prophecy is not when you can have children again, it's just when Drogo will return to you.
Yeah, I think that prophecy has brought it all the way, like, because it's a spiteful thing to say he will never be back. And that's just, hey, he died. That's all.
But I think it's also when your womb will quicken.
When your womb quickens and you bear a living child.
It's part of the... When Tata happens, he will be back. But I feel it mostly serves to put Daenerys into a whole thing where she thinks on it and she's like, what does it mean? And should I go west? Should I go east? It's just, it's, I don't think that it's really a prophecy. I think it has consequences.
It's a curse, kind of.
Yeah, it has consequences on Dany, but it's not really a prophecy.
Good, I'm glad we all agree.
Do you think there's some talk about the Dothraki seas sort of covering the earth one day? But I mean, I guess that's one of those prophecies that...
That's ghost grass.
Oh, right.
Said by the Dothraki legends.
Yes. But that, I mean...
Yeah, that's their legends for the others.
Yeah, I mean, it's six million ways to die, choose one.
As a parallel to the others, and maybe this is their interpretation, or I mean, I'm sure there probably is evil ghost grass in the Shire that like kills everything. That's awesome, but yeah. So if anyone has nothing else to say on prophecies, now we can go to all the ideas that I put down to discuss. So theories and ideas of note that were introduced in A Dance with Dragons. The first is Southern ambitions. What do you got to say about that?
Interesting. I mean, was this brought in with new knowledge from A Dance with Dragons, or was it...
Well, so Lady Dustin says the phrase, Lord Rickard had Southern ambitions.
God, she drops the next one as well, doesn't she?
I would like to combine the two.
Dropping the mic everywhere.
I think that they are intertwined because... Maester Wallace, who is the bastard of one of the Archmaesters, is dispatched to Winterfell. And according to Barbary Dustin, Wallace spends most of the time talking to Rickard about how great a Stark-Tully match would be. And this is what Southern ambitions... Well, this is the Southern ambitions as mentioned in the text. And then readers have gone on to interpret this as relating to the various inter-kingdom marriages between the heirs, which... happened occasionally in the past, but not to this extent.
Well, so to that point, do you think that it was all instigated by this one maester, or did just Rickard Stark and the North just get in on the party?
I think the maesters were the ones that have been fomenting this alliance, because again, Barbary Dustin also talks meaningfully about how the maesters, you know, they start off as your servants, but soon it is the servant that is ruling the Lord and yada, yada, yada. And I think this is important. So I think the Southern ambitions comes directly from the maester upper circle. But what do you guys think?
To what end?
Is it for the, like, to push the Targaryens out? Was that the purpose?
Yes, yes. So to what end? I have a couple of thoughts. The most people suggest that either they wanted to instigate Robert's rebellion, or they wanted to force a council to get Rhaegar to rule. I don't think either are true. I think forcing Robert's rebellion seems like a mistake. It seems like a three-part plan that doesn't have a third part. So if Robert's rebellion was their end goal, you know, it worked without a hitch. Why in a Game of Thrones is the realm in such a state of neglect? You know, I would imagine the maesters would have like a part three to implement for their, I don't know, world peace strategy or something that was cool. So I tend to not view that as being their end goal.
If they do want peace, then marriage alliances obviously would make sense, especially the sort of last alliances, because like, it kept the realm in pretty high levels of diplomatic stability, and only even all the other ones outside the lines combined couldn't topple the alliance.
So here's my take now. I think that what the Maesters wanted to ultimately achieve was a power stop on Aerys. So from the world of Ice and Fire, we know that Aerys was getting more and more insane. And so basically the Maesters were hoping that by making this power block, they could implicitly say to Aerys, hey, you need to keep shit in check, because if you do anything crazy, shit's going to hit the fan and you're going to have to deal with this rebellion. And in this great moment of tragic irony, you know, Eris was just so crazy by the end that he just didn't give a shit. And so he kills Rickard, he kills Brandon, it provokes a rebellion, and it's the rebellion that was never meant to happen. It was always just meant to be an implied threat. And as a result, the realm is now fractured, it's splintered, it's not this cohesive state that the Maesters were trying to make it. So the people who thought themselves wise ended up fucking up. That's what I think.
So I don't understand. Like, we hear from Marwyn that a part of the Citadel's, like, mission statement was to kind of remove magic from the world and, you know, bring in knowledge and science or whatever. Why would, like, I get, why are they protecting?
I agree, that's one of their strategies as well, but they can have multiple strategies.
Well, to that point, I think they also have, like, it's also, the Maesters are also individuals with their own agendas sometimes, I would assume. And I think it's most likely a combination of what individual Maesters wanted and tried to set in motion. And it doesn't necessarily have to be one unique decision that they all took and were like, okay, that's the plan. It's necessarily more complicated than that.
I mean, sitting on the small council is the Grand Maester, so why aren't they, you never see him pushing an agenda that says, you know, be careful of, you know, doing X, Y, or Z because, you know, the Northern Lords, the River Lords, and the Western Lords are all marrying each other. You know, like,
you never see him really do anything. I mean, we don't really have a point of view on what happens before Volbert's rebellion. We know kind of what happens, but we don't see anything that specific, I think.
Well, but we do. We have Barristan, and he even mentions that, like, Varys was feeding his paranoia, and, like, if Grand Maester Pycelle was doing something, you'd expect him to...
That's true, but it goes to my point, actually, that... it's not necessarily the Maesters as a whole trying to influence things.
So regarding
that's a whole conspiracy theory, right?
Yeah, one which I don't like.
I am of the opinion that this is a super secret meeting between the Archmaesters because, you know, as we find out, Varys knows who the Grand Maester is going to be elected before it happens. And I don't even think that Grand Maester Pycelle is necessarily a part of this. The way I think this works is they might dispatch a certain Maester to the certain right lord, like in Winterfell's case, or they might send a letter from the Archmaesters to a certain Riverrun or to Casterly Rock and say, we think it would be wise that you encourage this marriage between these two people here, and don't say this to anyone. This is just how I think it runs. And so with someone like Grand Maester Pycelle, he obviously represents the general view of the Citadel. But you see, in his case, he's clearly got a favoritism towards Tywin Lannister. And that's, you know, something personal that's developed from his own experiences.
You don't think that's linked to the conspiracy as well?
No, I think this is just based on his own personal experiences. In the same way that Varys and Littlefinger have been shaped by their early childhood and early adult life, and that influences who they are as we see them. But yeah, I could be wrong.
I don't know, like, it feels like too much sort of like treating people as sort of like chess pieces for George's style of lighting, which is really makes sense.
I just don't think the Maesters have that much power. Doesn't feel like,
I agree.
I think in maybe certain situations, Barbary Dustin might be right, and they've whispered in a lord's ear and gotten this or that, but it's maybe just happenstance.
I think it's maester by maester who's ambitious enough to know that their lord can't read or
exactly.
Whatever, and then maybe they feed him bogus information, but it can't be, I mean, not every lord is, like, not only illiterate, but, like, just that gullible, right? You talk about, like, chess pieces, like, the only way Littlefinger is able to manipulate everything is because no one expects him.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that, like, this does by no means applies to all Maesters, but this, just a few of them might have some plans, and again, this also relies on happenstance. It's not like they're the ones ultimately pulling the strings. I think it's just they have a bit more a bit more influence, and they're not as neutral as we've been led to believe.
Yeah, I agree. But with that nuanced version, that it's mostly the individuals who have ambition or not, and it's not one great conspiracy that's doing everything.
So moving on, we have the dangers of grayscale, which, similar to the words Southern ambitions spoken by Lady Dustin, we have Val, who absolutely freaks out about Shireen having grayscale. What do you think of this?
If it's related to, like, the others that interest me, the grayscale thing, I've never quite understood exactly how serious it could be, just because I didn't, like, it only seems to be transmittable through touch. Someone can correct me on that. But my understanding is that it was only transmitted through physical contact, and that just doesn't seem like it would lead to that big of a plague type deal. However, if like the nature of the disease itself is like linked to magic or the others in some way, that would be interesting to me.
I think it actually can be transmitted by water and airborne particles, because like they say, when going through the mists at the Broken Bridge, like everyone kind of freaks out. And oh, and obviously Tyrion falls into the water. Like he doesn't touch a stone man, but everyone is like, again,
oh, I thought he hit someone on the way down.
Yeah, it's because he's Targaryen.
Gets, like, pushed or gets knocked down.
Yeah. It's because he's a Targaryen. That's right. But John Connington dives in to save him, and that's how he gets it. To my knowledge, John Connington did not touch anyone. So I think this can be spread by beyond just physical contact.
So according to the internet, it's extremely infectious, being spread through touch, contact with an infected person, or even via unsterilized objects which have been touched by the infected. So even if it's not airborne, it obviously can last for a long time on other surfaces, which I guess...
Ringing any bells.
And they mention, I think Volantis sends a group of people to give the stone men food. And no one wants to do this task because a lot of them end up coming back infected. So it just, yeah, certainly waterborne. You can get in the water and then shit's going to get fucked.
Right, because isn't it mainly carried by the fog or whatever?
Yeah, but I have another question. Like, even if it does develop into a full plague situation, like, would that be really that interesting?
I think it would be interesting if it developed in the north, where they'd have to, you know, quarantine for 14 days, and then the others are through the wall and just
pick off. We already have a lot to see into, and to, like, there's a lot happening already when you see how in our world a plague has like stopped everything. I don't really know what it would bring to the story. I think it might be important for certain characters like Shireen and John Conn, but not necessarily.
Do you think it could be a sort of moral question where, like maybe like being a stone man like gives you a certain level of resistance to the others and their influence, so you get this moral quandary where like they're intentionally infecting people with it.
I don't think that'll be a plot point.
I don't think that. No. I would just think that a lot of the, it seems like, you know, a lot of what John thinks is like, together we can fight the others, but we, you know, we're better all together. So if we need to be isolated, or if there's a plague where, you know, people are wary of coming together to fight this great other, you know, invasion, then.
It's already going to be difficult enough, the invasion and fighting of the others. I feel like there's already quite a lot of obstacles and things in play that we don't need another one. But I don't know, maybe the current events are going to influence that anyway, and it's not decided, so whatever.
All I have to say is that Val has never been wrong when she says something. So to me, this just reads like Chekhov's grayscale. But like you, Marie, I don't know how exactly it's going to manifest in a narratively relevant manner, but we shall see.
I always thought the grayscale of the sorrows was like a water curse, kind of, if you have, you know, fire magic and stuff, because it was Garen the Great, wasn't it?
Garen?
Yes, I agree with you. There's the drowned lord who supposedly lives beneath the ruin or whatever. But yeah, this strikes me as a magical based disease that has a bit of
less,
not just leprosy, guys. It's magical leprosy. All right, that's enough discussion about plagues and pandemics.
A slight counterpoint to the Maesters. I wanted to talk a little bit about Marwyn here, and I feel like it's probably the only place. Do you think we have seen him at all in A Dance with Dragons as part of a sellsword company or something? And perhaps that's going to be a...
Miri Mazdur references teaching under him, that he had traveled in like the East.
Oh, yeah. Tell me more, Varley. Under him.
Jesus Christ. I'm gonna take off my shirt first.
All right. Look at our sex-based bumper.
No, she mentions to Jorah that a maester from the West came and, opened up a body and showed them how, the body works and stuff like that. And yeah, I think we're supposed to believe that that's Marwyn based on the information we get later about him.
Yeah, it is. It is 100%. I'm thinking, on his journey over, do we see him as part of a sellsword company? Because he's described as quite bullish and probably would...
He might just be another Quentin. He gets over to Essos, is like, boys, I'm here, and then gets burnt up by a dragon.
Well, I was saying is George usually likes to kind of give you an example of how something can be done and then replicate it with a perhaps more successful character in Marwyn who might actually get somewhere with Daenerys than Quentin. But as in he could hide himself in a sellsword company and make his way that way too. So he could be a character in the Windblown that we hadn't seen, and it could maybe make that whole Tattered Prince thing a bit more... exciting.
Maybe, but I don't see the need. He needs to get to Daenerys, so he's going to go to Meereen as fast as possible. That won't involve getting a sellsword company.
But is that George's style for him to just sort of pop out, oh, I've just been hiding in this barrel on Victarion ship the whole time,
it kind of happened with Barristan, right? He was hiding as Aerystin Whitebeard for a while.
So going by the chronological reread, which we have just done, Marwyn leaves basically at the end of A Feast for Crows, which is well and truly into the story of A Dance with Dragons. And it makes me think that in terms of who's going to arrive first and last to Daenerys, I think Marwyn will be on the tail end. He's behind Mokoro. He's obviously behind Tyrion. I wouldn't be surprised if maybe Daenerys meets up with him in Volantis, just because it might be nicer to stagger these advisors getting to Dany. But yeah, we'll see.
I have a question. Do you think that Pate will go with him? Maybe that's his employment contract to get rid of the dragons by tagging along with Marwyn.
So in the final Feast for Crows chapter, Marwyn leaves, but Pate stays behind, and he says to Sam, "Oh, hi, I'm Pate. I'm gonna be sharing a room with you," or something like that. And I just get the impression that Pate, Faceless Pate, his interest is getting that iron key, which he now has, and using it to get into the vaults of the Citadel.
Ah, thank you, Michael.
He should be around Sam's story, and maybe he'll be around when Euron appears, which might be fun.
Anything else we'd like to say concerning Maesters, concerning Marwyn?
Marwyn's the author of the Book of Lost Books. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's cool. He gets referenced by Qyburn, who
says he believes in ghosts.
Yeah, he thinks that's
cool. I'm afraid of no ghosts.
One thing which I don't think I'll ever get to bring up again with Miri Mazdur is that the last bits of her name, Mazdur, might be an SOC interpretation of the word maester.
Ooh.
Blow anyone's mind. Wow.
Jesus. Good thing I'm sitting down.
Good thing I already have my shirt off.
Shirt off, sitting down? Christ, Marley.
But yeah, when you look at the Lazarine and Dothraki names, they tend just to be Eerie, Jicky, Miri. They're not long like this. So yeah.
I like that. I like that. I tried to. I've got a couple of things that we'll get to. That's like, because Bina, I think on the last podcast, you and Greg were talking about the slight regurgitation of material that maybe we've all experienced over the last 9 years. So, yeah, that is very welcome. It's not something I've ever heard of.
You can trust Michael for bringing those up. Always new knowledge.
Another jewel in the crown.
So let's go on to the Grand Northern Conspiracy.
That's a conspiracy I believe in and that I like, which are two different things.
So, Mary, tell me your rendition of the Grand Northern Conspiracy, because I'm a believer of some parts of it, but not all of it.
Oh, damn. I like the idea, and I'm really, like, the parts that happened in the North all throughout dance are my favorite, and Theon chapters and so on. But I don't think I understand really what's happening. I just like this idea of the North remembers, because it resonates with earlier parts of the story when all was centered on the Starks and the Starks' children. So that's what I like. But I don't know for sure that there are that many things at play. And again, I think there might be a bit of conspiracy in the fact that different people are involved, but there's also, for me, a lot of individual ambitions in that and individual revenge ideas that play a part.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a lot of independent actions appearing as a kind of patchwork conspiracy, if you will.
Good. That's what I think as well.
I think, for sure.
The Manderleys. We know the Manderleys are working to bring down the Bolton Frey Alliance.
Hell yeah.
He's being assisted by one of the Glovers. Galbert Glover or Robert Glover?
Galbert's dead, I think.
Yeah, so it must be Robert Glover. I feel like that.
I think they're both still alive, aren't they?
Oh, but sorry, Galbert is one with Mage Mormont.
Yeah.
With Ned's bones and all that in the neck.
Ah, yep.
Yeah, but Robert's up north.
Yeah,
Arya helped to save Galbert at Harrenhal.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yes. I think I was actually kind of really hoped that it would be some huge mega conspiracy that everyone was like sending secret ravens and it was all just going to turn out well and yay, Rickon's back. But it's definitely not going to be that way. It's been a bit more steady. It's, you know, yeah, everyone it's
too,
working.
Too difficult to pull off.
And I mean, I'm completely lost on what Lady Justin is doing and which side she is on. I don't understand her anyway. So
her game is quite interesting. I think it was the whole thing with Stannis stuck at the Crofters, and having the Raven and learning about how ravens can only fly in one direction, and then realizing how difficult it actually is to correspond across Westeros. This is just
I'll send a text.
This is just solo anger. This is just everyone just pissed off on their own, and it's gonna be like, oh, you were pissed off too. Oh, sweet.
Yay.
Yeah.
Unless they all have glass candles.
Well, but they don't. They don't all have one.
They don't have maces. They have children of the forest telling them what's going on.
Talking to the trees.
I personally think that Lady Dustin works best as this wild card. She really doesn't like Ramsay, so she's ambivalent on this whole Bolton Frey thing. But she also clearly doesn't really like Ned Stark, which I think is going to make her also ambivalent on the Starks when they return. And this is just
put her on Arya's list.
Yeah, maybe she won't be able to reconcile her Stark differences. But I think when you go across each of the families of the North, and even like the Mormonts and how each of the different Mormont ladies have responded with whoever they're supporting, there are a lot of conflicting motivations and conflicting actions, like the Car Stark lady. Someone say
Alice.
The name? Alice. Also an Elise Karstark, who was going against her family, who are throwing their lot in with they're throwing their lot in with the Boltons and pretending to throw their lot in with Stannis, but they're really planning to betray Stannis. So my point being is there's a lot of competing motivations, and if they're all just secret Stark loyalists, it makes it less interesting, and it also makes Wyman Manderly less awesome for going out on a limb here.
Yeah, I mean, Karstarks aside, you've kind of got a lot of independent rebellion. I mean, you've got the Mormonts, who are weirdly split as well. You've got all the houses are kind of weirdly split like that. You know, the Mormonts, you've got some with Stannis and then some refusing. Well, Lyanna refusing Stannis, but I guess, again, is that separate factions? Are they discussing? You've got the Umber Bros.
One of them's in Winterfell, one of them's without.
Yeah, you've got, and then as you say, the Karstarks. Kind of split. You got one with the Thens now, full on wildling, and then you've got Harrion in the south from a Karstark perspective, who's still the heir to come back and claim Carhold.
I do think that when the Boltons go down, and they are going down, no one's going to be sad to see them go. Like, all of the families will be like, all right, I'm not sticking up for you. Maybe the Riswells, but they're going to get overpowered very quickly.
Yeah, probably not for long, right?
Going into A Winds of Winter, I think that these conflicting motivations might factor in over Winterfell, and, you know, which Stark will lead them, I think, will be interesting. But that's more Winds of Winter, and it's not really a Dance of the Dragons.
That's quite interesting, actually. Does that kind of help the point of the Grand Northern Conspiracy being so many different factions that maybe at the end of it they all have a different Stark? Would be quite interesting to see.
That's something I believe very strongly. Like, in the Dance with Dragons, we see Wyman Manderly. He's telling Davos, go get Rickon. Rickon is going to be our Stark. But I think Elise Karstark is going to be all for resurrected Jon because of, you know, Jon naturally helped her out. And then you have Mage Mormont coming up with the Will of Robb Stark, whatever that is. So I think, a lot of... It'll be a revival of the Starks, but there will still be some tensions, which the Dance of Dragons have set up.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
If we never get wins, will all these unfulfilled conspiracy theories just become like an aneurysm in your head?
it'll drive me crazy. The fact that the possibility we might not get a definitive answer, and the fact that I won't have the chance to go, ha, I told you so, I was right, you were wrong, I this is what I live for, frankly.
Excellent.
Well, you'll have to write your own fan fiction version that proves yourself.
Yeah, it'll come out soon, don't worry. The real Winds of Winter.
Yeah, that we wouldn't get anything more. Let's just not.
Hey, I gave a very exciting update earlier. We are fully on. It's happening.
Yeah, he is still riding. What?
But he's stuck in his cabin. He can't go anywhere else. He can't, can't go to conventions. He can't make more television deals. This is good, guys. This is the silver lining of COVID-19.
Well, apparently he can, because he was talking about all his television shit. And
You know how everything is going like virtual, and we have meetings on Zoom and stuff like that. Well, he can do it. So I'm not sure he's all about writing, but anyway, we'll see if we won't. Like, it's not like we can calculate the impact of this on his writing, but I think we will have the next book. It's just when. Anyway.
So if no one else has anything else they want to say on the Grand Northern Conspiracy, we
can... Go. Not necessarily on the Northern Conspiracy, but this fits in here best. Looking at the north, and where one area that we've not maybe, well, not when I've been on podcasts, have talked about too much is Torrhen Square. And what the hell is going on there? And let me drop a little knowledge on you kids about House Tallheart and how they stand. We have Helmond, who's the head, who's died at Duskendale. Benfrid, the son, was the head of the Wild Hares, who died. Aeron drowned him when Theon was raiding the Stony Shore. And Leobold was killed in the Winter Town by Ramsay, who was Helmond's brother. And now there's a girl called Eddara Tallheart, who I pray with that name becomes a badass at some point. Dagmar still holds Torrhen Square. And I think when Ramsay sent the letter to Asha at Deepwood, he also sent one to Dagmar. And post the Battle of Winterfell, depending on the outcome, could Dagmar be like the get out of the North kind of card for Asha and Theon to get back to the Iron Islands and do the old, Torgon the Latecomer on Euron?
That is a good point, which I had not considered.
I would love to claim credit for it. I did look at very, very in depth on the many, many forums and found someone who kind of put me onto this. But yeah, Torrhen Square, it's the last kind of piece of the puzzle in the North, really.
From a narrative perspective, I feel like Asha and Theon, they're going to serve as good viewpoints to have at the start of Winterfell in, again, the Winds of Winter. But going forward, there's going to be more and more point of views showing up in Winterfell, and they won't be needed for that perspective. So I do think that, yeah, rendezvousing with Dagmar, getting back to the Iron Islands at some point. I'm not sure when. That seems likely.
Do you think our boy Theon's making it?
That depends. That depends if it's Theon or just if it's Asha or Asha and Theon. I think we were discussing this in one of our recent podcasts, that it could go either way. Like, if Theon dies now, it's a good send out for him.
If they do the Torgon the Latecomer, does that mean Theon becomes king, or does that mean the old Kingsmoot is null and void and he can throw support behind Asha?
Asha's becoming queen 100%.
Right, yeah.
Opinion. I kind of agree with that.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering, because, again, I mean, ignoring the ham-handed attempt at a Kingsmoot in the show, it was like, does the Ironborn, can the Ironborn support a woman? I know she got a lot of support at the Kingsmoot, but with a male heir of Baelon, albeit,
we ain't got no dick. he's gonna pull his pants down at the Kingsmoot. See, I can't do anything. It has to be Asha.
Oh boy.
I'm about to say, if enough Ironborn get killed, maybe, like,
which might be very likely.
Yeah, it might take somewhat of a call, like, within, you know, with Euron leading them off to war and stuff, and like, if they have enough significant losses, like, I think.
Well, there's that Amin's theory of the heir to the Iron Islands, right, from years ago.
Ugh.
I don't know that one. Say it. Like, explain it to me.
It's that the lady that Theon was sexually abusing on the way to the Iron Islands for the first time got pregnant. And so that is the bastard son of, or daughter of Theon.
Okay.
But I think it's much more satisfying if Asha becomes queen.
Well, I was about to say that, frankly, with whatever Euron is doing, I don't really know what the future holds for the Iron Islands, or if they're going to, like, actually be a thing in the future, like, when all of this is resolved. I mean, I think it's going to be chaos because of Euron.
Yeah, let me tell you, Marie, what's going to happen. Or at least just strongly suggest that Euron's
upcoming...
Bring on
upcoming... that mansplaining.
Let's
go.
I'm going to mansplain this to Marie. I'm sorry. The upcoming battle between Euron's Iron Islanders and the Redwyn fleet is just going to be calamitous for the Ironborn. They're just going to get... Euron's going to do well, but I think the Ironborn are just going to get obliterated, whatever, in this upcoming naval battle.
Teabagged.
I really want, like, the Citadel to fall, because the Hightower flag and Euron's flag create Sardon when put together. So I just want him to take over there because of that.
Oh, yeah. He's gonna take over the Hightowers and stuff. But I just think his rank and file Ironborn are just going to be, they're going to be the soldiers to be sacrificed. And they're not going to be so hot for Euron after this.
Well, he said as much, right?
Well, they'll be dead.
He's like, I gave them the islands, and it's up to them to hold them, and they probably won't, so...
But I think, yeah, this, yes, yes, you're right, you're right. And this is going to be the spark of, you know, these are different times. Maybe we can have a woman rule for us. But yeah.
I think I said this on the main podcast, a podcast of Ice and Fire, but like the Iron Islanders are just dicks and no one would miss them if they did get wiped off.
We like, yeah, Roderick the Warriors, Reader.
I think Roderick is going to die. I'm going to miss him.
Don't you dare say that. Ned can die.
Yeah.
No, don't you dare say that. Like, Davos and Roderick are making it to the end, wrapped in fucking cotton wool.
You know who else is going to die that you will love? Garland Tyrell.
Oh, that's fine. That's cool. He's sweet and he's definitely badass.
I'm real scared for Garland.
We need him in the final battle, man.
Yeah, Michael, why is that again? I think you told it on another podcast, but I forget. I don't pay attention when we're talking.
Oh, why Garland is going to die? Yeah. This is more just on a hunch that, you know, he's going back to fight Euron, and I think Euron is going to be killing lots of people, and just there's three Tyrell sons, so I think Willis will be the survivor. Garland and Loras are going to die.
Loras is allegedly already incapacitated, though.
He's just badly burnt.
Yeah, he's been scalded with oil, but he
tis but a scratch.
But his life expectancy isn't going to be very long in King's Landing.
Very true. He's destined to die. Quick one on this Theon. Last thing on Theon with Jane Poole. Do you think that these guys will get married one day, and that this could potentially be an Iron Island and the North, if she continues to be fake Arya until such point, kind of an alliance, the first in the history?
Why?
I think Jane Poole deserves a better husband, and one that has a penis.
I think that would be a very, like, sad start of whatever relationship. Like, how can you go back from being in that position to, like, any kind of relationship, really? No, I'm really not hoping for that.
I mean, am I asking, do you think they'll fall in love? No, but I think, you know, a lot of marriages are done in this world for political purposes. And if
but neither of them hold any political anything. Yeah. I mean, all they could say is, like,
well,
no.
if Jane's like,
I'm really not interested in sex anymore, and Theon's like, well, I can't give it to you anyway, so...
Well, if Asha takes the Iron Island, yeah. If Asha takes the Iron Islands and Sansa takes Winterfell, then they do.
If Theon does survive the upcoming events, I don't see him surviving, like, beyond the Dream of Spring. Like, he's gonna die at some point. I don't see him living
Fair enough. I mean...
And in the fanfic that I'm writing, the story ends with Sansa making a really nice match for Jane, and she ends up with a happy husband who respects her and loves her.
Oh my god, if there's any justice, Jane gets to cut Littlefinger's throat.
Oh yes.
Ooh, well, add that in as well.
Excellent.
Oh, that would be
good. Ideas, good ideas.
Okay.
We've got
religion, which I've got a couple of things, actually.
Okay. The growing power of religion.
I'll let someone do the introduction or whatever.
Oh, there is none. It's just the growing power of religion.
Perfect. There we go.
Bravo.
I wanted to ask you guys about the faith. Often kind of underestimated, I suppose, because they have no magic, allegedly. Certainly compared to the old gods or Alor or something. How do you think, or what do you think, is going to be the consequences of the faith militant? And looking back on the history of how they were put down the first time by Maegor, and then obviously ultimately Jaehaerys, the conciliator. How do you think this will play out with the faith militant as this new power, this new army that's almost just kind of come out of nowhere? In terms of manpower,
are they a new army?
A militia.
It feels like it.
I mean, are they any bigger than the Brotherhood right now? Like, I feel like there's a number of, like, sure, proper knights, but, like, other than that, they're just walking around with, like, cudgels.
Yeah, but I mean, the Brotherhood are what, like, 100 dudes at best?
Yeah, but those are 100 hardened fighters, not a bunch of pussies that want to serve the Seven or whatever.
No, but 100 hardened fighters against 5,000 guys in robes with cudgels.
And also, why are we putting those two in competition? Like, the, I mean,
well, the Brotherhood's lore, right?
Yes, okay, but I mean, not, no, not really. Like, yes, but it's more about the people than really about the faith they have originally. But I, like, I think both can have an impact on the story, and the faith militants can be a big thing without necessarily in a different way than the Brotherhood. And I think, like, the faith is one thing that not everyone has in common, because yes, the not everyone worships the Seventh, but it's still a big thing throughout Westeros. It is actually getting already big. I think it will definitely have an impact on the rest of the story.
I think the faith militants are going to be instrumental in finally bringing down the Lannister regime in King's Landing. That seems like a given.
That doesn't seem like a stretch.
Yeah, and like overall, like I mean, maybe not the faith militant, but just like the faith in general could probably play a big role in the perhaps upcoming civil war between like Dany and Faegon.
I've said previously, I think the High Sparrow is going to be in love with Aegon and be like, he is who we've prayed for. He is the savior. Come again, yada, yada, yada. And so, yeah, they'll be Team Aegon. Daenerys might have the support of the Red Temple, so maybe she'll bring some of her Red Temple peeps over. And so these two religions, I'm sure, are going to get along great. There's not going to be any religious wars or misunderstandings, you know?
Yeah, that seems like it would be interesting, and it makes sense. Yeah.
It does feel like the king that combined the faith to them will be the dominant power in King's Landing, certainly. Because I feel, I mean, Varys even says that was one of the reasons he killed Kevan, was because he was doing such a great job at tying the two together.
That's probably true for a time, I think. But then whoever that is, maybe Faegon, is going to fail against like the real threat that is the Winter and the others. And that's where the faith will just be like, okay, so we are useless.
Faced against real magic.
Yeah, exactly.
But it generally has been nice in A Dance with Dragons to see so many of these religious groups expand in a way that is meaningful and just adds to the world building while also being relevant to the plot.
Yeah, definitely. And also so many different representations of the religion. So you have, I mean, probably the most you have, I guess, the faith and R'hllor in terms of examples of people who follow the religion, with say Davos, the High Sparrow, Lancel, and then also for R'hllor, Melisandre, Thoros, Mokoro. Interesting to see how it has a different power over everyone.
Well, the only I mean, I think we've talked about this before, but like the only power that we've seen religion exercise is through R'hllor, the Weirwood Trees, and maybe the Drowned God, but we haven't really seen it come through for the Seven, right?
We've definitely seen the Many-Faced God. Otherwise, how do you explain the the face changing?
Right. So, but never from the Seven, never from the Faith. So,
arguably with Davos.
Oh, he hears the Mother. But that's, nothing ever comes of it.
No.
That represents his subconscious thoughts.
Sorry,
manifesting.
Well, I mean, if you believe he's Azor Ahai, then, you know.
Oh, well, I don't, so here we go.
But I think that the Faith are going to find themselves like, I don't know, I feel like it sets up, the Faith Militant are like the products of like just poorly managed government, because they're all pissed off because the war in the Riverlands wasn't protecting them and they needed someone to protect them, right? And then they're empowered by poor leadership through Cersei by being able to militarize again. I don't see them actually being a power that in the end really means anything, though, because they're gonna, you know, they're gonna probably see the invasion of the others as like, well, that's deserving that the Northmen who worship trees and not the Seven, that they get that. And, you know, and I feel by the time it gets to them, they're not going to really have much of a force to fight against the others or, you know, whatever is coming for them.
I agree with you, Volley, that they're going to be like a flash in the pan. Like, they're very important now, and I think their power base will be concentrated in King's Landing. And without getting into more Winds of Winter predictions, I think a calamitous event will happen in King's Landing that may affect their power base.
Well, we know that Fagon's going to King's Landing, so it's going to be besieged, right? And then if Daenerys ever makes it there, she's coming with dragons, yeah, so... We can expect something bad to happen at King's Landing.
But yeah, the Faith Militant is like, they are a populist movement. You know, they've been enabled by bad governments.
Yeah. I wonder if all Fagon would have to say is like, what Baelor the Blesser, or the Jacarys the Conciliator promised, I will carry out, and that's what will make, like, back him over anyone else, over Cersei or Tommen.
I don't think that was enough. Like,
So the Faith back then were pissed at Jaehaerys and the Targs in general for
Baelor.
Interbreeding, right? It was and that's why the law of exceptionalism kind of.
After getting like flamed by Maegor a bunch of times, they learned to sort of tolerate it a bit better.
Yeah, and then that's why Jaehaerys is the conciliator, because he reconciled the Faith with the Targaryens.
But it was the incest that infuriated the Faith so much.
Right, but then they came up with like Targaryen exceptionalism or something like that, where it's like, we look down at other people's incest, but not ours.
But then, so what are the Faith angry about now? If you compare the two scenarios, it's not really angry, it's a power grab.
Yeah. It's the small folk suffering, which is what the High Sparrow goes on about, and how this is an unjust monarchy that's not protecting its people.
That's why I think that it, like, Aegon or Fagon doesn't just have to show up and say, hey, I'm your new king and I'm going to do right by you. It's going to take a bit more than that.
Yeah. I had one last thing. Yeah. Old gods and some new shit for us to dive into. Bran's visions through the Winterfell heart tree. Quite a few of them have been dissected quite easily, but there's two that have not, that I wanted to throw out there with you guys and hear what you had to say. The first being a pregnant woman coming out of the Black Pool in the Godswood in Winterfell, praying for a son to avenge her. And the second being a bearded man forcing a captive down on his knees, and a white-haired woman killing the captive with a bronze sickle.
So the second one is probably the easier one. So let's start with that one. That is the most far back in time one. And I think this just represents the first men, because they're using bronze. And it's just meant to remind us that, hey, the first men were all about blood sacrifice to these heart trees.
You don't think the white-haired woman has anything to do with, like, the bride of the other or something like that?
No, I think she was just maybe a religious first men, like a member of the religious caste of some degree.
Okay.
I think they're the same woman and they're both old men.
Well, that's solved number two. So great.
There's something I found online about that, the pregnant lady, which was, she is the Stark girl who had the child of Bael the Bard, because the telling of Bael the Bard through Ygritte to Jon portrays him as a hero, whereas perhaps he was not so much. And you can use the example of Rhaegar with Lyanna, how, depending on who you ask, he's a hero or a villain.
Why would she want vengeance when her son kills Bael?
Because Bael maybe did something bad to the grandfather Stark.
Yeah, or maybe she's pissed that Bael kept her in the Winterfell crypts for a year.
But, like, if he is already dead, she already had her vengeance, right?
It's perfectly valid. I have no problem with it.
I don't know.
There was another one that it's, and this is complete fucking tinfoil, that it is Melisandre in the future having a baby to avenge Stannis.
Get it off.
Nope.
Good.
So the white-haired woman, I'd figure, like you said, might be like some kind of priestess or whatever, because even the Ghost of High Heart is white-haired with like red. Like, it seems like if your physical features resemble a heart tree, there's something special about you.
True. Was there, I mean, is there, does that kind of denote interbreeding between the Children of the Forest and the First Men?
I'm sure a couple of them got weird one night in the long winters.
It's implied that the Reeds are descended from Mixes. And there's a couple of mentions in the Wild West and Fire as well.
It's cold and lonely during those long winters, man.
So, did we cover...
Yes, annoying interruptions is done. We can move on.
It makes a good segue now. These strange visions we see through the Weirwood to the Children of the Forest that we see for the first time in A Dance with Dragons.
Yes, absolutely.
Epic.
Matt, cool. do you have something to say? Or, I mean, Vali...
What?
Did you just want to be there for the discussion, or did you have something to say about the Children of the Forest?
Yeah, just kind of the Children of the Forest and the whole Bran aspect of dance. It was really underwhelming, even though like I expected it to be like unlocking all these mysteries for some reason. Did anyone else feel like that?
I wanted more chapters than three.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the main thing. It's definitely. Just, it feels like it was cut, and he's like, nah, we'll do this later in the next book, 10 years later.
There's, like, a lot of magic that needs to be explained, and, like, here's the Children of the Forest. I'm sure they could tell us some things, and, like, we don't get any of it.
We get some, I guess, but not the stuff we want. One of the interesting things I discovered or read was when Leaf, the main Children of Forest person we see, talks about how she's like 200 years old and she went and mingled with humans in the past, which makes me wonder, was this confined to Beyond the Wall or did she journey south as well?
I have to believe it's just Craster. She's the one that's been taking the babies.
Well, if she does go south, it sets up a maybe interaction between Duncan and Egg. Maybe when they're in Winterfell. This is a super long shot, but it's conceivable that you could have some Children of the Forest walking around masquerading as small people, but we'll see.
So now we're counting on two separate publications coming out? Jesus.
leading to Summer Hall.
There's something cool actually, like an SOC parallel of the Children of the Forest called the Woods Walkers, a vanished race from Northern Efsos, they are called Woods Walkers. Fuck you for making me pronounce this. Ifequervon.
Yeah, pronounce the forest they live in.
Ifequervon.
Quervon, yeah, okay.
And everyone's favorite explorer, Corlys Velaryon, visits the last city of these people called Vaes Lisi. I'm definitely not reading this off the wiki right now.
Ooh, which is City of Ghosts.
And it talks about carved trees, strange silences, haunted grottos, which all sounds very Children of the Foresty.
So we get a Children of the Forest grotto in Arianne's chapter, right?
Yeah, we do.
Oh, very cool.
Because obviously back in the day, they were all over the Seven Kingdoms.
And I think this is evidence that they were also in Essos as well.
Exactly, yeah. That there was planetary plate shifts or whatever.
Or maybe a moon fell in between and created an ocean, then the ocean rushed in. Moon came dragons.
Either scenarios are plausible.
Oh, they just traveled there?
Well, we already know about the broken arm of Dawn and how the children split Westeros and Essos there, right? And the Stepstones, and that's how that came about.
Sure. Supposedly, they did that.
Right, yeah. It's whether or not it was a natural or magical.
Yeah, sorry, boys. I wasn't there firsthand.
Disappointing.
But it was interesting when Leaf talks about, you know, we used to be everywhere and now this is our long decline. And like, it's really a long decline. Like, if you think the Children of the Forest, their heyday was like prehistory when the First Men hadn't even made it to Westeros, when they were still like probably getting killed by people on Essos. Like, they're old.
But don't the elves and Tolkien say the same thing? Like, we've been facing the long defeat.
Oh, yeah. This is, like, the Children of the Forest are clearly George's parallel to the elves.
Agreed.
It makes me wonder if the children of the forest have any memories of the fish people from Ashai and all over the world.
The squishers?
Yeah, the squishers, the people under the sea and stuff. But that's getting even more ancient. So maybe they're just from different points of time.
Well, maybe one day we'll find out when Wins has three more brand chapters.
Okay. Does anyone have anything more to say on dance as a whole, or on just whatever you hope for next?
Well, I gotta go, guys. I don't have anything left to say, but it's been great, and what a journey this reread's been. Huh?
Oh yeah.
Bye, Matt.
All right, bye, guys. Have a good
bye,
one.
Bye, Matt.
See you, Matt.
Stay safe. Stay healthy. Wash your hands.
Later on. When there was a podcast.
Yeah.
I'm getting sentimental right here, so.
Oh, what do we do now, guys? Oh.
I know, right? Did anyone else have any last things to say? I had one more thing.
Well, what do I have? Similar to the reread of A Feast for Crows, where I acknowledged that there wasn't really so much fat that needed to be cut from A Feast for Crows, I had the same opinion of A Dance of the Dragons. There still was more than what you find in a Feast for Crows. Like, it is expanding, but it's not. Maybe a fifth of A Dance of the Dragon chapters at most needed to be edited or cut, whereas before I would say like a third of it needed to be trimmed down. So my opinion has improved of dance from many rereads.
Good, because it's all we got.
You hear that, George?
I guess
now
rounding
that
we off
finished
our...
the podcast, that the lead that George can finally release a book.
Yeah, we finished the reread.
Yes. Here we go.
Yeah. One last thing. I suppose my last point is on R'hllor and some of the badasses we see, the priests. But Thoros, how do we all feel that he's going to... we think he's going to play a role in Jaime and Brienne's escape free? Because we all think they're not going to die. And we obviously see Jaime walking into a trap with Brienne at the end of Dance. And Thoros seems like a defeated man.
I was thinking that you have the Breakaway Brotherhood Without Banners group, and they come back and launch an attack, and
wow,
that is what enables Brienne and Jaime to escape or whatever. But
it isn't that segment of the Brotherhood Without Banners busy doing some crazy shit with Edmure?
Oh God! No, so that's Tom of Seven Strings, and I think he's part of the Lady Stoneheart faction. So I don't think we know where Edric Dane and his posse is at. We've just been told that they left, and that's about it.
And Harwin.
Harwin, Engwe, the Archer, maybe. I actually have not good knowledge for who belongs in which camp.
No, too many conspiracies, not enough groups. Okay, so no crazy Thoros feelings. Okay.
I guess it would be nice, but I also feel like he's played his role already, and it was kind of already bigger than what you could have expected from his character.
Well, what a journey that character's been on, coming from the pisshead friend of a king to the outlaw resurrecting.
Yeah.
You know, religious fanatic almost.
Yeah. But I think that was his main role in the story, and I'm not sure. I mean, it depends on what we would prefer, really, between some new character having anything to do with how Jaime and Brienne are freed, or someone we knew already. But I think there would be others in the Brotherhood that I would find more interesting than Thoros.
Well, Thoros saving would be interesting. I think we all want to get a little more insight into Lemoncloak, who is a big enigma.
Let's wrap this up. I'm going to say that this was a huge pleasure to be doing all these episodes with you guys and whoever else was on the podcast during these 106 episodes. Oh, my God. And, well, we will keep doing whatever we are doing and podcast about a lot of interesting things in different fandoms, I expect. And I'm very happy to do that with you guys. So yeah, that was it for dance and A Song of Ice and Fire until now.
We're at the end. Oh. It's like there's an abyss before us, and all we can do is fall down.
I don't know. No, we have lots more to talk about. It's just we're going to stop talking about A Song of Ice and Fire, I expect, a bit, just because we've said a lot of things already, but there are a lot of other things in fantasy and science fiction and just everything we're interested in.
Anyone excited for the Dune movie that's coming out soon? This is, sorry.
Yeah,
this
is cool.
Start the after.
No, it is. Let's start it. This is the start of the after show. So I just wanted to say to all of our listeners that now is the time to, like, don't hesitate to reach out and tell us what you thought overall of the reread, if you thought it was nice, because we don't want bad comments since we're not going to improve ourselves now that it's done. So. And if you have best moments, best clips of funny things that happened during the rereads, just tell us. We'll be happy to put those into maybe a best of episode soon. And yeah, that's it. Shall we say goodbye and then talk about whatever? Okay.
Any suggestions for future podcasts? Give us a
shout. Yeah. Let's do that, because we need some. Okay, well, bye everyone. I'm really happy to have done this last podcast of the reread with you.
Thank you, Marie. Bye.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bina. I think we should have a big round of applause for Bina, who put this all together from beginning to end. And who's going to edit this episode?
Doing faster than light speed editing. Yeah. I don't know how you do it.
So big thank you, Bina. Because this is what brought us all together. Woo!
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
And the fact that we finished it and didn't like stop halfway through.
Yeah, just a bit crazy. Okay.
Woo!
Yeah.